Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. Namo Buddha, Namo Dharma, Namo Sangha. The different talks which I had since the last teaching gave me the inspiration that it might be the right time now to talk with you about what is a Mahamudra Bodhisattva. A new word. Mahamudra, you know, Bodhisattva, you know, but the two belong together. So we have done so much insight exploration, and I will give you a little different entry into the path by talking a little bit about the background of that tradition. One of you wrote me a little note asking, can you define Mahamudra? What is the meaning of Mahamudra? Actually, one person came here into retreat or got interested because Mahamudra is an asana in the yogas. Yes, but it's not that. It means the same, it's the same root. Maha means great, okay? Mudra means here, you know, normally mudra in Tantric Buddhism means a gesture. It is a physical expression. But here, mudra is the other meaning of the word, which means a seal of authenticity. Like in the old times, when the kings or someone sent a letter with wax, and then the seal was on the top, so that the unbroken seal arrives at the destination and shows this really comes from the person who makes the seal. Now, it's the great seal. And the seal that we are talking about is that all phenomena have the seal of the empty nature. We have been already exploring the empty nature a little bit. I prefer the word ungraspable. Yes, you remember I was using this much more. So, due to the fact that appearances, that means whatever we live, all our experience is changing all the time, not even standing still for any observable moment. So, this constant dynamic nature of everything we experience is also its ungraspable nature. It never becomes something solid for even a moment. It doesn't have some substance to it which wouldn't change. So this is called the empty nature. And this is true for all of our experiences, for all phenomena. And that's why it's called Maha. It is Mahamudra because it is the seal for the mega Maha super all phenomena, yeah, in this sense, because it is an all-encompassing truth that is the central teaching of the Mahamudra tradition. So when someone practices Mahamudra, then by definition, we practice the direct seeing of the ungraspable nature of all of our experiences. Yes, I will repeat that. I see some of you are writing. So we are practicing the direct seeing of the ungraspable nature of all our experiences. And that in itself is not saying so much, right? What does that mean? From the Vipassana point of view, Mahamudra is to stay in Vipassana all the time, in meditation and an action. And here's the real vipassana, the insight, the real insight, the non-dual insight. That is what is meant. So Mahamudra, like in the announcement which you were sent when I described this, what we are going to share now, I think I called it the practice of natural being, something like this, I usually do. Because this is the hallmark of the Mahamudra approach, that this insight into the empty nature is not produced through an analytical reasoning or through an idea about everything being empty, but it is that which becomes obvious when you relax, and you relax, and you relax more, and you open more, completely beyond any manipulation. So completely giving up every way to manipulate one's own mind, to cling, to stress, to strive for something. This approach, completely relying on how it is when there is no more clinging, this will give the insight from within into just how it is. That's why I taught you the six dharmas of Tilopa. Remember the five no's and then the one go. Do not reflect about the past, do not anticipate the future, do not think about the present, do not analyze, do not meditate, leave the mind naturally as it is. Yeah, so this leave the mind natural as it is. This is actually what we are doing in Mahamudra. And this leads to an understanding of the dynamic nature of everything. That everything is energy, you can say. It's forces in the movement. It's fields of energy interacting. It is this interbeing in which actually we can say that everything is ungraspable, but we also say that everything has an effect. It's not just empty. I talked to you about the fullness also, the five aspects of timeless awareness, remember? So it's not just empty in the sense of spacious and vast. It is dynamic, it is fluid, it has a taste to it. One taste is the taste of equality, of the empty nature, and the other taste is the vivacity, the diversity of the experience, that what makes life so enjoyable, which is the, you know, thanks to the differentiating quality of mind, then it is so vivid. So the Mahamudra teaching on the, or the understanding of the empty nature is one, yes, that appearances are empty, that the clear nature of mind, the luminosity, is also without substance, that the awareness itself is empty. Yes, all of that is dynamic. And there is this creative side of mind. There is this dynamic side with the finely differentiating awareness. And this is this is what we call the timeless awareness, with all its different aspects. And you remember the teachings about the unity of compassion and wisdom, where the two really become one. And this is thanks to the fact that our natural mind is sensitive. It feels. It has the natural capacity to perceive, to know, and to understand. And so, remember, there was this passage where I talked to you about that the sensitivity has a receiving aspect, where due to our connection with everything, we are able to feel so much. We perceive the world with our senses. We have fine antenna for what is going on in the world around us, in our own mind, in our body, everywhere. Yeah, this fine resonance, I called it. Remember, the resonance is this one aspect, but in the resonance, you know, like a drum, when you have two drums next to each other with two sides each, you have one drum here and one drum there. You beat this drum, that drum will start vibrating. And we are like that. When something is going on around us, we vibrate. And that is the natural state of being. An awakened being, a Buddha, whatever you want to call it, resonates with the situation around, resonates even, you know, with a tree, obviously, but even with one stalk of grass, will resonate even with that, will resonate with a little breeze of wind, will resonate with the sun and with the rain and with whoever looks, you know, wherever the eyes cross, whatever, all the colors, you feel the resonance. And this resonance, due to understanding the empty nature of what is being felt, yeah, all of this, this resonance is possible because there's no clinging. When you cling, it's like you put a hand on the drum. Then the surface of the drum cannot resonate so well. It tries to resonate, to vibrate, but the more you press, the less it resonates. And this is a good description of what happens in samsara. We block the natural resonance because of the clinging. So we cannot feel so much. And when you have had difficult experiences, we almost do it on purpose. We don't want to feel so much because it's too much. Yeah, it's overwhelming. So what we need is when we let go of the blockage, we also need to open up the space of wisdom. It is this spaciousness that allows for the resonance to go its way, and it dissolves by itself. Whatever arises as a phenomena in one's experience, whatever experience arises, it dissolves by itself. That's its dynamic nature. It goes into the next experience. Nothing stays. Now, when we have seen that, when we know and trust that empty nature, that ungraspable nature where everything is self-liberating, then we can relax into that resonance. We become that living resonance, and then we observe that the second part of the resonance, the creative, active side, is now not only concerned with our own happiness, but actually becomes of service to the overall situation. No matter what is there, if it's a plant that needs to be watered, a baby to be taken care of, a teaching to be given, whatever is there, there is a resonance, we feel the situation, and in the situation, if that is something disharmonious, if that is something which is kind of, you know, grinding a little bit, yeah, then this is very strongly felt. And there is an automatic, a spontaneous response of this resonating awareness to help loosening up the stress in the situation. And this is the active side of compassion. Okay, this is actually where we allow the resonance to resonate out, to make a sound. If I stay with the example of the drum will make its own sound. And in correspondence to what is felt, then the Buddha talks. The Bodhisattva shares the Dharma, shares that which can help to have less stress in the situation. And it doesn't only mean that one is only taking care of it doesn't even mean one is only taking care of human beings. There's so much more to take care of. Yeah, so there's stress in the environment. There is stress with invisible beings. There is everywhere one can feel there's imbalances. So a bodhisattva also in that is like impartial, is unprejudiced. Wherever the energy goes, wherever there is a resonance felt, there will be an answer. Sometimes the answer is just a little prayer. It's like a ray of light, some rays of light going somewhere. And it's an incredible phenomenon to understand how a bodhisattva is actually working. A bodhisattva doesn't so much have a plan of what to do in this world. It's more an attitude of simply being of service. You know, since the striving for one's own benefit has ceased, yes, there's no more wanting to achieve something, then one can be of benefit. And let's see which situation needs it most. And this is where the energy goes. So yes, there is a structure in the activity. Yes, a bodhisattva has to take care of just how much energy goes where, and you know, so that there is a continuity in the activity. But basically, it is just a phenomenon of this resonance, which is the unity of compassion and wisdom. So before it becomes too abstract to you, let me make it very personal. I go back in my own life. I mentioned to you that Gyanri Rinpoche, when I met him at the age of 22, it was in 81, that his first weekend he taught was on bodhicitta. I think I mentioned. Yes, I did, huh? Anyhow, that resonated with me so strongly that at that time I thought, wow, this guy, I already felt he's quite old. He wasn't so old, but he had come from Tibet all the way, and he was teaching one only weekend in Freiburg in Germany. That's the only time he came to Freiburg, and I happened to be there. We were only 40 people. And for the first time in my life, I felt this person is walking the talk, you know? Walk the talk, this means like completely authentic. That every word that this person says is lived 100%. And at that moment, I regained my trust in humanity. So far, I had encountered so many solala spiritual people. You know, solala means not quite. Yeah, talking nicely. Kaha kaha. Yes, yes, something like that. Sounds good. I mean, it doesn't sound so good. No. So far, you know, I'd been upbringing in this Christian family and so on. And actually, the talk and the walk were different. The acts and the talk were, there was too much discrepancy. And I had been longing for some authentic example. So that encounter, that one encounter changed my life. And that is what I meant when I explained to you that the bodhisattva works like a catalyst. Remember that? Catalyst means just being there and allowing for an interaction, not really doing something, just being authentic, being there. And that inspired me so much. Then came the phase of practicing vipassana and so on. And at that time I had one girlfriend who brought me to Gyanri Rinpoche at that time, but then I had another one. I spare you the story. Women were always very instructive on my path. And then I got engaged with my later on wife, Irene, and she brought me, to make the story short, to Kalu Rinpoche. Kalu Rinpoche became then our first root guru, so to speak. We regarded him as our main teacher. And Kalu Rinpoche came to a small village in northern Italy, which my wife Irene and myself were taking care of. I was the homeopath in that village. Every month I went there to treat the people. And she had co-founded this Buddhist village, and we had built up the ruins, like there was only rocks left, and we made the houses again and so on. And Kalu Rinpoche, this old, frail monk, very powerful presence, very clear, he couldn't walk anymore at that time. So we fabricated this kind of Sänfte, we say in German. This is like two people in front, two people in the back, and each one Alunka. And we carried him up the mountain, because it was on the mountain, there was no road to this village. So we carried him up there, and he gave the Bodhisattva vow. He gave the formal promise to become a Bodhisattva. And I had a little bit of time to contemplate that. I knew what was the meaning. And it was very dear to my heart. I was still at that time a medical student. I was maybe in my fifth year or something. And I remember that, how I contemplated. He gave one teaching the first day, and then he announced for the second day he would give that vow. And I contemplated. I took the vow, yes. And I knew, and this is why I tell the whole story, because that's the essence of the vow. I knew from that day on that my life does not belong to me anymore. You look at me like I'm a truck passing by or something. This is the message. You give up your freedom of self-decision, and you're a servant to the true needs of those who you meet. So you don't serve the neurotic needs. It's not serving the desires of people and following their fears, but you serve their Buddha nature. And that moment, I really got the meaning of the Bodhisattva vow. At that moment, I understood that this attitude of becoming a servant, and that my life doesn't belong to me, that this will really change my life. Yes, obviously. And I understood there was an idea, there was a joy, there was a complete joy in doing that, but also there was a fear. There was a fear because, wow. And I didn't have the understanding of the empty nature at that time. I thought, wow, that's very inspiring, but that's the most inspiring I can feel in the world, to be truly of service and to find one's freedom in the service. Maybe some of you, in the experience of being parents, maybe you have lived that being of service to your children, or maybe being of service to your parents or to someone else, that this is an expression of freedom. And so you will not understand the Mahamudra tradition if I don't explain to you that it is embedded in this Bodhisattva attitude. It is actually not quite thinkable to practice Mahamudra outside the Bodhisattva path. Because what does it mean with Mahamudra and this whole combination? Because I'm going to talk a little bit about that now. Of course, it's an expression of compassion and love for sentient beings, of course, yes? But this expression of love and compassion is not stupid. It is not that someone thinks or believes that I can rescue the world, that I can change samsara, and that I can bring beings to enlightenment. You know, if anyone had been capable of that, then the Buddhas of the past would already have done that. This is not possible. You cannot bring beings to enlightenment. What you can do by compassion and love is to go the path as good as you can and then become an inspiring example for others to follow as well. You become a catalyst, right? This is a new word, but it's meaning the same thing. You become an inspiring example, everyone in his or her own way. So no bodhisattva or bodhisattva is the same as another. We are not imitating each other in the way we are, but the motivation is the same. The motivation is to go into awakening and to let this awakening be of benefit to all, without limits. So you're all very, very familiar, I hope, with the four Brahma Viharas, right? The four limitless qualities, the immeasurables. Now, if you let this love and compassion become limitless, not only in number for all sentient beings, but also limitless in time, then it means for all times. You don't put a limit. You don't say only for this life, then I take a vacation. You know, no. Love and compassion for all times, for all beings, no limits. And I have no idea what that means for all times and all beings. I just know it's big. Yeah, it's bigger than what I can think. And then you combine that with the joy. You combine that with the joy. This is the joy in practicing and sharing the wholesome. This is a special joy. So mudita does not only mean to be joyful with the wonderful, wholesome acts of others. It is rejoicing in all the wholesome there is in the world. Whatever is beneficial, you rejoice with. Personal, others, you know, It is that joy which makes you enter into all the samadhis. It is that joy which gives the energy to share the Dharma. It is that joy which makes you water the flowers. It's, you know, it's always, you know, it's that joy. Again, you understand? It's the joy of service. You get it? It's the joy of serving the world. It's a joy of generously sharing with the world whatever wholesome that is. This is mudita. So this mudita with the love, with the maitri, metta and karuna, this needs the very important equanimity. And this equanimity, you have heard about it in my teaching about the equality of all phenomena. The true equanimity is not something you practice. It is due to seeing the nature of all phenomena to be ungraspable, and then there is no attachment and aversion. So it's the wisdom side. I think you must have heard that in the teaching, so it's not new. So it is this equanimity which comes from truly seeing the ungraspable, empty nature, the selfless nature of all phenomena, that gives the service to all sentient being its actual dimension of nobody serving anyone. You see? There is not a clinging to the self of the bodhisattva. There's no one doing it. And yet, this body and mind are always in the service of everybody. But so natural that you don't even notice that you are serving. There's no concept that I need to serve. This concept that I want to serve is a preliminary. This is called the relative bodhicitta. It is the preparation. It is how we enter that practice by making these wishes repeatedly and so on until some realization arises, and then it just becomes normal. You don't have to tell yourself to do like this all the time, because that's actually the natural state of mind. The mind is naturally in service of the overall situation, of all beings and all trees and whatever, yes? It's naturally like that. It wouldn't occur to a mind without clinging to a self to be different. It doesn't occur. The ideas just don't arise. Because it's not important to take care of yet another happiness of oneself and another privilege, another something. You know, doesn't make sense, because one has already discovered the wish-fulfilling jewel of one's own mind, and there's nowhere to go. So naturally, this is being shared. So this bodhicitta, you have heard this word now many times, this bodhicitta, which is a little bit with effort, which is called the bodhicitta of aspiration, and then which involves the effort to apply oneself to the paramitas, generosity, sila, wholesome conduct, patience, joyful perseverance, you know, this energy to do the wholesome. This kind of effort, and also the effort in meditation, this is only preliminary. This is because our mind is still a little bit in clinging, and then we make an effort to cling less. Yes, yeah, no, you get it, but it's not much of an effort. It's more like releasing all the brakes, all that which stops the process, which stops the natural mind from manifesting its qualities. So the effort is as much as the effort of opening this fist. You know, actually, if you are honest, I'm making an effort to close the fist. Now, but since I'm so used to grasping, then it feels like this is the normal state. And then the Dharma teachings, they are like, how about starting with the thumb, you know? Like, you could... How to relax, you don't know? Well, lift the thumb a little bit. Okay, lifting it. Then let it, come on, let it relax a little bit. And now, okay, now stay like that. And now, no, don't go back. Stay. And then you do the same, you do the same with the index. Come on, there. You know, it's not so dangerous. You can let go a little bit more of control. Yeah, come. Yeah, you see, it's not so bad. Yeah, it's good. Now, stay. Yeah? Yeah, okay. Yeah, and like this, you know, all the Dharma teachings, they're about relaxing this hand, relaxing the grasping. How much effort is involved in that? It's incredible. But you must admit, actually, it's no effort, because we are just undoing a very unskillful way of dealing with reality. Constantly grasping, and then we are told, and we use so many techniques like developing devotion to the three jewels, developing love, loving kindness and compassion. We are contemplating impermanence and all of that, just to relax the clinging to something which seems permanent. We meditate hours after hours, and we think it's so much effort. Actually, it is just getting us out of all this distracting activity that is so exhausting, you know, just getting us out of samsara a little bit, little pause, and we call it effort of meditation. But from the beginning, Dharma is actually about doing less effort, to stop the wrong kind of effort and to go into the direction of something which is more wholesome. And it's all about this relaxation, yeah? relaxed mind, open mind, fluid mind, spacious, warm, you know, not so self-concerned, you know, all of what we have been talking about. So the Bodhisattva path knows that. And the Bodhisattva masters who give the vows, they know exactly well that no one is ever going to rescue anybody. There is no idea like that. It is just the way of talking that we are here to help everybody attain awakening, which we will do, but in a nobody's way. It is not by personal effort. Otherwise, as you know well with psychology, when you try to do something with personal effort, where do you finish? Burnout, right? It's programmed. You want to help all the students in your school, all the students everywhere, you run here, you run there, you burn out, programmed. Like a doctor in hospital wanting to save all the patients, fighting against death, you know, like fighting against samsara, burnout, programmed. So Bodhisattva activity is absolutely dependent on this insight in the empty nature of phenomena. That actually the samsara that we liberate beings from, so to speak, is empty by nature. It doesn't exist as such. These are forces creating samsaric suffering, creating dukkha all the time, but not extraneous forces outside of ourselves. It's our own mind creating this tension all the time. So what we need to do is we need to show ways how to relax the fist, huh? How to relax the grasping. And this is all of what we show is like how to be open, how to be in resonance, how to relax, how to reduce the unnecessary effort and to put in the effort there where it's needed. And from this morning's teaching and yesterday, remember, the effort is that with the right motivation, we direct our awareness. So the sati is being directed by, say, bodhicitta, say, compassion, is directed there where it is most helpful. And then, because the light of awareness goes into those areas, then things open. This is the only effort we are doing. The only effort is to go, to cultivate, to go with that motivation which is most in resonance with the world, call it love, call it compassion. We direct the attention where it seems to be most helpful. For that we need a little understanding, we need some study. We need to hear a few teachings, we need a little guidance to know where to direct our attention, and then we do it. And as we do it, we understand a little bit more. And that is already relaxing. This understanding produces an effect. When we understand the world more, we are a little bit less lost. We understand the working of the emotions, we know how to relax them, and we're a little bit more free. We look for the self, the so-called self, when it's not a clear realization, but already we feel I can't really find something solid there, something which I could call a soul or the core of my being. It's all very open and dynamic in there. Nothing solid to be found. So it already relaxes our clinging to the self. And that's the path of the Bodhisattva. The path of the Bodhisattva is inseparable from understanding the empty nature of all phenomena, Mahamudra. Yes? Even if it is called Dzogchen or if it's called Madhyamika, there are different names for that. Yes? But the understanding of the true nature of all phenomena is a must it's a must for the bodhisattva. Otherwise, a bodhisattva, a bodhisattva will get completely exhausted. Without that understanding, oh, you just have to look around and maybe look in your own biography. You were probably trying to help the world and you were getting very tired and you may have lost your joy. You may have lost the inspiration and you didn't know where to find it again. And for that, a Mahamudra Bodhisattva, which is saying almost the same thing, then it needs to have a direct contact with what I call the source. There was one teaching where I talked to you about touching into the source, right? A daily touchdown. Yeah? This is the daily connection with that dimension of being where there is nothing to be achieved. Okay? Nothing to be achieved means also nowhere to go, nobody going anywhere. It means that if I meet with suffering, the only thing to do is to dissolve the illusion which leads to the grasping that leads to the suffering. I need to dissolve the lack of awareness that leads to the grasping. Okay, the rest will follow by itself. So the whole task of a bodhisattva is to generate that field of awareness. Okay, you follow? To generate that field of awareness, which is stimulating to the awareness of others, so that they can tune in and they also find into that understanding. Oh, Shoshana. We have an agreement. Oh, I don't tell. And so this field of awareness is so helpful. It's so helpful because it is non-manipulative. A bodhisattva's way of action is always without manipulation. It's just an invitation. It's an invitation, as we say in the language of Tantric Buddhism, it's an invitation to enter the pure land, yeah, the pure land of a Bodhi, of a Bodhisattva, of a Buddhi or Buddha. Yeah, it's the invitation, hey, join in, you know, let your mind open to the same awareness that is the awareness of awakening. And this is what the Buddha did. 45 years of his life, he invited beings into his awareness. And he told everybody, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. There was never anything else he said. You are like me, you can understand, you can become free. And seemingly his field of awareness was so strong that thousands and thousands became arhat in his times. And the Bodhisattva tradition claims, and so many became bodhisattvas and bodhisattvas in his time. And this is what is the activity of a bodhisattva. And since this understanding of the empty nature of all phenomena includes also the experience of death, of the so-called death, which is leaving this body, leaving this dynamic home beyond and flowing on in the stream of experience, then the bodhisattva vow naturally includes all of the fluidity experiences that are still to come. So we don't know when the bodhisattva will dissolve into simply, you know, spacious awareness, but for as long as there is a manifestation, why not? We will definitely continue with sharing this awareness with everyone, every situation that this mind stream encounters. It wouldn't be logic to say this is only for this life. No, it is for the continuity of this developing stream of awareness. So for as long as that might be possible, as that might take, May everyone benefit from it. May everyone drink and eat from the nectar of timeless awareness. May everyone benefit from this being, you know. And then this comes, then you come to such formulations like in the practice of Chö, where we say, yes, come all beings, eat me up. Eat up this body, it becomes a nectar of timeless awareness, a nectar ocean of jnana, which is the word for timeless awareness. So vidya, huh? Vidya in Sanskrit is the same meaning. So this understanding, which is the unity of compassion and wisdom, this is actually the food for all sentient beings. And the wonderful discovery, I can talk a little bit about that from my life. Since then, since the age of 25, when I took the Bodhisattva vow, I think 25, maybe 26. Since that, I have never regretted. It has only been a joy, only. From joy, to more joy, to more joy, more relaxation, more openness, less and less fear. And really, it makes so much sense. And maybe from this now, after I've prepared you for a few days, and now having talked about the inside aspect of the practice, the Mahamudra side, and now talking to you about the Bodhisattva side, now perhaps you can feel how the two fit together. Yes, you can feel that. So these great beings like Nagarjuna, which you have heard, these were bodhisattvas, okay? Shantideva, or you know, I don't know whom you know, but there's many of them. And I have met in Burma, when I visited there, I have met bodhisattvas in the Theravada tradition. You should know that this also exists. And they are not limited to only this life, their bodhisattva aspiration. I've met practitioners in all traditions who are inspired by this to unite the deep understanding of empty nature with the practice of compassion. This is the unity of wisdom and compassion. And they are doing it in a limitless way. And they always say, there is no higher refuge than the four immeasurables, the four Brahma Viharas. But the four Brahma Viharas are understood like this. Yeah, this is what I was giving now, is of course a teaching about Mahamudra Bodhisattva, but it was at the same time just a teaching about the four Brahma Viharas. Yes, this is the real refuge. Okay. This much for now. It was a lot, huh? It was a lot. But now I have allowed you to look deeply into my heart. This is where the energy comes from. Yes, this is the real inspiration, because I have met people who live that. And I feel, wow, that's really inspiring. That's really the way to go. And you start as small bodhisattva, and then and you just continue. And wow, it's possible. It's possible. It sounds like, oh, when I heard it first, it was like up there somewhere, you know. Like, my God, but so inspiring, but so far away. And then it became so close. It became my life, and it's easy. It's not difficult. It would be difficult to live something else, honestly. To return to normal life would be difficult. To return to a life of self-serving attitudes would be very painful. Very, very painful. Ah, and since I think of it now, one person wrote me a little note. In order to follow this path, do I need to become a monk, or what is the condition of, you know, lay practice and so on? So I want to answer that quickly. The Bodhisattva tradition is especially meant for the lay people. It is very much fitting to also live that in a lay context, because all relationships are included, and especially the partner relationship. And nowadays, where we don't necessarily have children, we can avoid to have children, then the partner relationship is a wonderful learning ground for the bodhisattva or bodhisattva. It is where we, as you know, partners, they know all our buttons. Huh? They press here and you go. They press there and you go a different, you know, it's like, eh? So others, they don't press that, they don't come so close. They are very respectful. But the partner does it. And so it's a perfect learning ground, and especially, of course, if both are on the path, it's very, very helpful. But I have to admit that it is best to really devote one's whole life to the Dharma. So if behind this question is of becoming a monk or not, is the question whether it means devoting one's whole life to the Dharma or not, I have to admit, yes, I know people practicing in families and being married to a partner who is not practicing the Dharma and having done their profession, and they have done wonderful lives and growing in the understanding and being beautiful, inspiring examples of Dharma practice. However, they all regret, if they have not been able to do it full time, they regret this, that they couldn't at an early stage in life give themselves full time to the study, contemplation, meditation, because always they needed to integrate so many practical aspects of the life, and taking care of children is a big thing. And although you can make it a practice, then in your capacity to explain the Dharma, this lack of study, the lack of long years of retreat practice and so on, this shows, it makes a difference. So if that person who wrote that question wanted to know about that, then go for it. If you feel the time has come in your life, go for full Dharma practice and include the study as well. Don't neglect the study. And remember, we were contemplating a lot. So in between the study and the meditation, there is the contemplation. So do all three practices. And then you come to a very integrated understanding, and this will help a lot. But you don't necessarily have to become a monk. I myself, I was a monk for 21 years, but 10 of these years were very, very happy. And then I felt for the 11 years, I felt that my wish to share an intimate relationship was there in the background. It had come back again. So to my own surprise, because I felt so free of that, but it came back again. And fortunately, it is very easy in our tradition to give back the vows and to join the lay life, because above all, we are bodhisattvas. And which form of lifestyle you choose depends on your life situation. But one thing you never abandon is the bodhisattva vow. Whether you practice it in lay life or in monastic life doesn't really matter. It's a little different approach in the Tibetan tradition, like this. Same as in Zen, you know. Zen monks are also bodhisattva monks. They are not monastic monks with celibacy, because there was one Japanese emperor who didn't want the monastic sangha in Japan to be so strong, so he obliged them to marry. And so all they gave back their monastic vows, they got into relationships, and they continued as Zen monks, but with family. That's the origin of this strange thing with the Zen monk who is not celibate. The Bodhisattva vow dominates over everything. The monk ceremony of in Zen is a Bodhisattva vow ceremony. And the monastic aspect was not practiced in Japan from that time on, not very much at least. Okay. End of the talk. Thank you for being there and for making this talk come out. How about if we sing a mantra together? Yes? Oh. Lila, take your microphone or take mine. You lead the chant now. Oh, come on. Okay, we do it together.
Swaha. Om Tad.